Sunstone Theological Society presents the Book of Mormon Onomastikon, a methodological reappraisal, recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Forsberg. And there doesn't seem to be a chair today, and that's probably for the best. I have a long paper, and I can't even read it in its entirety. And I apologize for that. I hope that the portions of the paper that I read will hold together well enough that you can follow the argument. In addition to this, some of you have, all of you, I hope, have a handout with a glossary. Some of you may not need the glossary, and so I don't mean to imply that that you necessarily need it, but there should be at least one person that can make some use of it, as well as some tables that will come in very handily near the end of the paper. So with no further ado then, let me begin. The Book of Mormon Onomasticon, a methodological reappraisal. Of the many foibles that have been ascribed to the Book of Mormon over the years, such as its numerous plagiarisms and a literary style in prose that echoes that of the 1611 King James Version of the Bible, the problem of the more than 300 proper names that pepper the text has received but cursory attention. This is a surprising fact indeed, since this relatively small corpus of proper names may be said to encompass the original text and or language of the Book of Mormon, representing an important source of information regarding the origin of the text as a whole. Nevertheless, in an effort to address this question, scholarship has only proven to turn the Book of Mormon Onomasticon into a proverbial nose of wax, to be twisted any way one chooses. On the one hand, Hugh Nibley, the much-publicized and outspoken Mormon apologist, has gone so far as to say that the Book of Mormon Onomasticon represents, and I quote, the greatest bonanza any philologist could ask for in coming to grips with the Book of Mormon. Critics, on the other hand, have suggested that the Book of Mormon Onomasticon is little more than a combination of biblical plagiarisms and linguistic inventions, what one scholar has glibly referred to as graphic glossolalia. But the apparent lack of scholarly consensus regarding the nature and origin of the Book of Mormon Onomasticon is really only a symptom of a more fundamental problem, it seems to me. That being, a complete disregard for the modern comparative philological approach by contemporary scholarship. The result has been a hodgepodge of linguistic data that can best be described as mere guesswork and conjecture. This paper will endeavor to re-examine the question of the Book of Mormon Onomasticon, therefore, from a methodological perspective, focusing on essentially two questions. One, what is the nature and or quality of research in the area? And two, if philological analysis of the Book of Mormon Onomasticon is possible, and it may not be after all, how might this difficult task be accomplished? The paper will begin with a discussion of the history of comparative philology, outlining the various traditions and or approaches that have been employed throughout its rather long history. It will be shown that comparative philology is a composite of several different and divergent linguistic approaches, each corresponding to one of four historical periods: 1, ancient rabbinism; 2, medieval scholasticism; 3, Christian humanism; and 4, modernism. It will also be shown that the bulk of research addressing the subject of the Book of Mormon Onomasticon may best be defined as an unconscious imitation of the ancient rabbinic comparative approach, and not the modern comparative approach as one might first expect. However, to say that such an anomaly is the fault of bad scholarship alone is to ignore the very real obstacles and or analytical constraints imposed by the text itself. It will be shown, therefore, that a systematic and or modern comparative approach to the Book of Mormon Onomasticon is an impossible task given the constraints imposed by the text, which are essentially twofold: 1, the mysterious language of the text, and 2, a limited and inexact transliteration scheme employed by the text and or its author-translator. But just as no problem is without some solution, except perhaps the problem of a rational proof for the existence of God, it is the opinion of this writer that the key to understanding the Book of Mormon Onomasticon is to be found in source material that is contemporary with its 19th century American author-translator, Joseph Smith, Jr., and not source material that is contemporary with the ancient Hebraic setting reported in the text. It will be shown that the Onomasticon of the King James Version of the Bible represents the most plausible point of origin for the Book of Mormon Onomasticon, and that the so-called non-biblical proper names of the Book of Mormon are themselves biblical variants that can be explained and categorized in terms of various linguistic processes associated with a phenomenon known as word-making. A systematic classification scheme for the Book of Mormon Onomasticon in total will also be supplied, which it is hoped may serve as a foundation for substantive phonological and etymological analysis in future. Finally, utilizing a source like the KJV as the basis for the Book of Mormon Onomasticon may buttress theories favoring the exclusively 19th century character and origin of the Book of Mormon. Then again, such modern parallels may be explained as yet another in a long series of what one Mormon scholar has recently termed modern expansions of an ancient source. Regardless, if the Book of Mormon Onomasticon as a subject of study is to be taken seriously at all, then a more systematic and honest comparative approach must be employed. Now, the first section of the paper deals briefly with the question of the history of comparative philology, and I just really don't have time to read it. Let me just turn to the summary of that chapter and read from that point in the paper. In summary, then, comparative philology can be defined as the study of correspondences between languages that are related in origin. This is the modern definition. However, it is important to note that this definition is problematic insofar as it does not acknowledge the linguistic efforts of the rabbis, their medieval counterparts, nor Christian and Jewish scholarship during the Renaissance, all having contributed to the modern science in one way or another. Of course, the difference in perspective and linguistic erudition between these early attempts at comparative analysis and modern works is profound, to say the least. Nevertheless, comparative philology may best be defined as the sum of all its parts, each contributing to the whole, but from different historical and linguistic perspectives. Book of Mormon Philologistics, the Rabbinic Approach. Utilizing this inclusive definition for comparative philology, we can proceed to inquire as to the nature and or character of philological analysis of the Book of Mormon Onomasticon to date. Surprisingly, the bulk of research in the area seems to share more in common with the comparative approach of the early rabbis and their medieval counterparts, more so at least than with the modern comparative approach as one might first expect. Again, in this connection, it is useful to consider the fact that the rabbinic comparative approach was characterized by a striving for the production of multiple meanings, which in many cases were not restricted to the literal form of the text. This preference for the production of multiple meanings was often exacerbated by the employment of a highly creative and imaginative eisegetical approach, which also exhibited a strong preference for allegorical interpretation and pseudo-etymologies. Above all, the rabbis were masters when it came to manipulating language and authored several characteristic linguistic devices with this in mind. For example, they would often divide words arbitrarily into free and bound morphemes, small linguistic units of meaning, inventing meanings for words of questionable and even known origin. Proper names were often the target of such speculative etymologizing. They were also extremely fond of pseudo-etymologies, which were established on the basis of loose phonological correspondence alone, analogous in some respects to the modern-day pun. In addition to this, they believed that any verse in the biblical text with words sharing one or more phonemes, units of sound akin to the alphabet, served as another clue to meaning, a practice known as assonance or paronomasia. However, the linguistic wizardry of the rabbis was never a scientific process and was really designed to serve their individual apologetic and or polemic interests by and large. With this in mind, let us return to the matter of the rabbinic character of Book of Mormon philologistics and draw a few comparisons. Interestingly enough, Joseph Smith, the author translator of the Book of Mormon, was the first to try his hand at philology as a means of defending his Book of Scripture in the wake of severe criticism. Soon after the publication of the Book of Mormon in 1830, several of its critics pointed out, and with some delight, that the proper name Mormon had come from a Greek noun meaning monster. Obviously, the comparison was never intended to substantiate the book's classical origins. Sensitive to criticism of the Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith published the following counter-argument, in which he stated, and I quote, "It has been stated that this word, Mormon, was derived from the Greek word mormo. Before I give a definition, however, to the word, let me say that the Bible in its widest sense means good. We say from the Saxon good, the Dane god, the Goth gota, the German gut, the Dutch goed, the Latin bonus, the Greek kalos, the Hebrew tov, and the Egyptian mon." Remember that. Hence, with the addition of more, M-O-R-E, or the contraction more, spelled M-O-R,
we have the word mormon, which means literally more good. On the one hand, Joseph Smith's etymology for the proper name Mormon cannot be taken seriously, and perhaps that was its original intention. Nevertheless, it may be useful to consider the fact that this enigmatic combination of modern English and ancient Egyptian really only serves as the linguistic basis for what is primarily an allegorical approach to the question. That is to say, Joseph Smith endeavors to defend the Book of Mormon by suggesting that the goodness of the Bible ought to be ascribed to his own book of Scripture as well, which he considers to be essentially more of the Bible. Hence, the proper name Mormon, from which the book takes its name, is defined as more good. What is noteworthy about Joseph Smith's philological approach, therefore, is not its linguistic validity, but its allegorical nature, and as such, its distinctive rabbinic flavor. Since the discovery of the papyrus from which the Book of Abraham was allegedly translated, Joseph Smith's facility as a translator of ancient languages, particularly ancient Egyptian, has been harshly criticized, and for good reason. Nevertheless, his early attempt to defend the Book of Mormon via comparative linguistics is significant insofar as it has given rise to a certain brand of Mormon scholar that, at first glance at least, would appear to be equal to the task. Ironically, modern philological studies of the Book of Mormon onomasticon, at least within Mormon scholarly circles, have failed to offer much in the way of scholarship that is different in kind, at least, from that of Joseph Smith. Since the publication of an exploratory philological study of the Book of Mormon onomasticon, entitled The Book of Mormon as a Mirror of the East, Hugh Nibley has amassed an extensive and even impressive body of research, which at first glance would seem to support his theory of an Egyptian Lehi, and or the Egyptian origin for what he terms the quote-unquote strange names of the Book of Mormon. Needless to say, his work in the field represents a pioneering effort, and the fact that he has dedicated himself to a defense of the Mormon textual tradition may explain the high degree of chronological looseness that is characteristic of his work as a whole. Suffice it to say that his philological approach to the Book of Mormon onomasticon is problematic in several respects, as well as sharing an affinity with the rabbinic comparative approach to some degree. In this vein, Hugh Nibley has described his comparative approach to the Book of Mormon onomasticon as what would seem to be little more than random selection, as he explains, and I quote, "But aren't we using unjustified violence when we simply take the names at random and place them side by side? This is just what is most remarkable. We did pick names at random, and we had the whole Near East to draw on, with Egyptian names by no means predominating numerically the list before us. Yet the only Old World names that match those in our Book of Mormon episode all come from Egypt." Not only is such an approach analogous to looking for a needle in a haystack, perhaps a needle in a thousand haystacks, but Nibley would ask us to believe that he has not only succeeded in recovering the elusive object, but a quiver full of them. Nevertheless, there is much about Nibley's comparative approach that is rabbinic in nature. For example, his treatment of the Book of Mormon proper names Pahoran, Pa'anki, and Pakumeni, which are said to derive their origins from the ancient Egyptian proper names Bahura, Pachyank, and Pamenech. Akin to rabbinic pseudo-etymologies, Nibley's comparison is based almost entirely on a loose phonological correspondence, albeit reinforced by the fact that both sets of names are said to refer to magistrates. But in this case, any semantic correspondence that might be drawn between the two sets of proper names is invalidated, since, as Nibley himself points out, and I quote, "the names compared are never exactly alike, since names are bound to undergo some change with time and distance." Nibley's comparative approach is also reminiscent of the rabbinic practice of arbitrarily dividing words into free and bound morphemes as one means of explaining difficult vocabulary items. A good example of this is his treatment of the Book of Mormon proper name, Irientum, which the text interprets for the reader to mean many waters, and which he suggests may either be an Egyptian word, a Hittite word, or perhaps both. As Nibley explains, and I quote, "But what about Irientum? It is not a Semitic name, and Lehi goes to the trouble of translating it. It has recently been shown that one of the more common Egyptian names for the Red Sea was Iaru, which is not Egyptian, and the meaning of which is unknown. That would take care of the IRRE element in Lehi's name, while Antum can be matched with two characteristic Egyptian forms, both describing large bodies of water. On the other hand, since Iaru has never been explained, could it be related to the old Indo-European word for sea, the Hittite form of which is Arunash?" In this case, the question might be asked, how very different is Nibley's comparative approach from that of Joseph Smith? Both employ arbitrary morphological divisions, as well as referring to several different and unrelated languages in their analysis of Book of Mormon proper names. Regardless, Nibley's comparative approach is demonstrably rabbinic, given his preference for random and or loose phonological correspondences, pseudo-etymologies, and arbitrary morphological segmentation. Recently, scholarship has endeavored to show that the so-called non-biblical proper names of the Book of Mormon are largely Semitic in origin, calling into question, to some degree at least, Nibley's theories concerning their exclusively Egyptian nature. In this vein, Joanne Carlton and John W. Welch, in a preliminary report entitled Possible Linguistic Roots of Certain Book of Mormon Proper Names, have supplied translations for the first 10 non-biblical proper names in the Book of Mormon, excluding Jaredite proper names. An ambitious task indeed, Carlton and Welch only succeed in confusing the reader with a myriad of equally plausible translations for each of the 10 proper names under glass, imitative of the rabbinic propensity for the production of multiple meanings already referred to. In the case of Alma, the well-known Book of Mormon protagonist, this proper name is explained in terms of any one of four translations. One, to cover or conceal, which is said to perhaps refer to the instance in which Alma concealed himself from wicked King Noah. Two, eternity, which is said to perhaps refer to Alma's preaching on the subject of eternal life. Three, to be silent or dumb, which is said to perhaps refer to Alma's rebellion when he was struck dumb. And four, which is my favorite, to be widowed, which is said to perhaps refer to Alma's ability to flee at a moment's notice and the rebellion of his children, who, in spite of nothing in the text to this effect, must have been deprived of their mother at an early age. Hey, thanks. You're still awake. That's reassuring. A similar approach is taken with the proper name Amaron, which is said to accommodate no less than five divergent translations from which no clear choice is discernible. In addition to a propensity for the production of multiple meanings, Carlton and Welch also refer extensively to allegorical interpretations in their analysis, although it should be stated that this is primarily the contribution of Welch to the study. Thus, allegorical links between the various etymologies that might be ascribed to Book of Mormon proper names with events portrayed in the text may be said to represent the second prong of their comparative approach. In some instances, allegory is even employed to indicate etymological preference, such as the case of the proper name Abinadi, which is said to mean, "My father is present," since this particular translation, at least as far as Welch is concerned, can be tied to Abinadi's most significant and controversial message, namely, that God would take flesh and be present among humankind. However, it is the arbitrary manner by which Carlton and Welch divide Book of Mormon proper names into free and bound morphemes that is perhaps the most conspicuous of their rabbinic comparative tendencies. For example, they divide the proper name Abinadam into two free morphemes, Av and Nad, and two bound morphemes, E and Om, suggesting that it may mean, "My father is a wanderer." This is using the Hebrew verb nuth. But what may appear to be a very plausible etymology, especially since Abinadam is purported to be a wanderer, albeit in the writings of Jacob, from whom he descended, this is Welch again, is problematic if one considers the fact that the proper name Abinadi should share essentially the same meaning, given the fact that it is composed of the same free morphemes of and not. And yet, Abinadi is translated differently. "My father is present." To further complicate matters, one might argue that the Hebrew verb nuth, a hollow verb meaning to wander, flutter, or show grief, is common to both proper names, and therefore Abinadi might just as easily be translated as, "My father is my wandering," while Abinadam might be translated as, "My father is their wandering," since the final suffix of each may well be the Hebrew first person singular and third person plural pronominal suffix, respectively. Finally, Carlton and Welch base much of their comparative research on loose phonological correspondences, which may be one reason for the multiplicity of transliterations and translations which pervade the study. In summary, then, this is the bit you really listen to because it makes sense of all that's been said. And of course, you know. In summary, then, Book of Mormon philologistics exhibits a strong propensity for the rabbinic comparative approach, whether knowingly or not. It may also be fair to say that Joseph Smith's employment of a quasi-rabbinic approach in his dubious analysis of the proper name Mormon has served as something of a precedent for modern scholarship, whether knowingly or not. The result has been a comparative approach to the Book of Mormon on the Masticon based on random selection, loose phonological correspondences, allegory, pseudo-etymologies, and the arbitrary division of words into free and bound morphemes. Book of Mormon philologistics, the modern comparative approach? In spite of the rabbinic tendencies and her character of the philological studies of the Book of Mormon on the Masticon discussed, the question of the validity of this body of research depends largely on its compatibility, or incompatibility for that matter, with the modern comparative approach. Indeed, the rabbis never pretended to be scientific in their approach. However, modern comparative treatments of the Book of Mormon are very different in this respect and do, it seems to me, in many cases, masquerade as a modern scientific philological approach, raising questions as to their real scientific nature and or validity. Again, in this connection, it may be useful to consider the fact that the term comparative is often misconstrued to refer to comparisons between languages that are not related to one another. As James Barr, the well-known biblical scholar and philologist, explains, and I quote, "It might indeed be supposed that there is a quite different task which is more properly comparative, that is, the study of differences and similarities between languages which are not related in origin, Chinese and Hebrew, let us say, or Turkish and English. Comparisons of this kind, though not without their interest, are not what has usually been meant by the term comparative philology. This term has meant the comparative study of language groups with which signs of a common historical origin can be detected. Comparison is not a general discussion of similarities and differences, but the construction of a common scheme within which the material of related languages can be placed." By referring to this definition, we can also surmise that the modern comparative approach is founded on essentially two tenets. Obviously an oversimplification, but I think that it works. One, it is restricted to the study of languages with which signs of a common historical origin can be detected. And two, it is predicated on the construction of a common phonological scheme for related languages. We can proceed to inquire, therefore, as to the compatibility of Book of Mormon philologistics with these modern comparative philological maxims. But returning to Barr's initial caution pertaining to the popular misconception that comparative philology refers to the study of differences and similarities between languages that are not related in origin, consider Ethan Smith and his speculative treatise on the Hebraic origin of the American Indians, entitled View of the Hebrews, in which he attempted to draw various linguistic comparisons between tribal languages and ancient Hebrew. While one might scoff at the rather simplistic nature of Smith's linguistic efforts along these lines, it should be stressed that his comparisons are problematic given the fact that there is really no historical basis for such a comparison in the first place. Native American languages are not related to, nor do they stem from, ancient Hebrew. Interestingly enough, Book of Mormon philologistics has fallen prey to the same analytical pitfalls and faulty assumptions, or so it would seem. In this vein, Joseph Smith's reference to modern English and ancient Egyptian, or for that matter, Hugh Nibley's reference to ancient Egyptian and Hittite as the possible source for the Book of Mormon Onomasticon, is also problematic, since in each instance, reference is made to languages that are not related in origin. Even John A. Svetnis' phonemic analysis of the Book of Mormon Onomasticon, entitled A Phonemic Analysis of Nephite and Jaredite Proper Names, stresses the apparent Hebrew and Egyptian origin of the Nephite Lamanite proper names, as well as the Akkadian and Sumerian origin of the proper names, of the Jaredite proper names, excuse me. This in spite of the fact that Hebrew is not related to Egyptian, nor is Akkadian related to Sumerian. Indeed, a comparative linguistic analysis recently published by Brian Stubbs, entitled Elements of Hebrew in Utu Aztecan, A Summary of the Data, is perhaps the best example to date, perhaps the worst example to date is the word, of a haphazard and inclusive comparative approach typical of Book of Mormon philologistics. Reminiscent of Ethan Smith's linguistic speculations, Stubbs' tenuous comparison of a wide range of Aztecan tongues with all Semitic languages is a perfect example of what is not, properly speaking, comparative philology. However, failing to restrict comparative analysis to languages that are related in origin, Book of Mormon philologistics also fails to adhere to a system of close phonological correspondences. Regarding the latter, it is important to note that the modern comparative approach is characterized by a strict adherence to precise phonological correspondences, as James Barr explains, and I quote, "It is very desirable that phonological relations should be very closely established. The looser the phonological correspondences, the more the weight of proof must fall on the semantic suitability of suggestions offered. But semantic suitability under these circumstances, in other words, the fact that two words might have the same meaning, is perhaps not much more than mere guessing. It is wrong that such guessing should be justified by the argument that phonological correspondences are not rigorously mandatory." In other words, it doesn't matter whether the names sound alike or not, and that the sense achieved fits perfectly well. Compare Barr's argument with that of Nibley, who defends his own loose phonological approach by turning comparative philology on its head, as it were, suggesting that, in fact, loose phonological correspondences are to be preferred. As Nibley explains, "It will be noted that the names compared are never exactly alike. This, strangely enough, is confirmation of their common origin, since names are bound to undergo some change with time and distance. whereas if the resemblance were perfect, we should be forced to attribute it, however fantastic it might seem, to a mere coincidence. But the real problem with Nibley's loose phonological approach is that he is seldom consistent in this regard, and often contravenes his own philological maxims. For example, in his treatment of the Book of Mormon proper names Korihor and Sam, he argues, whether or not Nehi or Nehri are in any way related to the name Nephi, there are other Egyptian names that come nearer, remains to be seen. But no philologist will refuse to acknowledge the possible identity of the Book of Mormon Korihor with the Egyptian Cherihor, and none may deny, philologist or not, a close resemblance between the Egyptian Sam and Sam, the brother of Nephi. To be fair, Nibley is not alone when it comes to a flagrant disregard for close phonological correspondences and or questionable references to languages that are not related in origin as the basis for comparative analysis of the Book of Mormon Onomasticon. Nevertheless, his work in the area is considered by many to be definitive of Book of Mormon philologistics as a whole. It is unfortunate, therefore, that his comparative approach is problematic. In spite of Nibley's methodological failures, it may be useful to consider briefly the content of two phonemic studies of the Book of Mormon Onomasticon, which represent perhaps the most sophisticated work to be done on the subject to date. In the case of John A. Sventna's phonemic analysis already referred to, he suggests that there is a notable difference between the Jaredite and Nephite phonemic systems, which would seem to support the claims of the internal history of the text. However, another study utilizing what seems to be the same phonemic approach by John R. Kruger, entitled An Analysis of the Names of Mormonism, argues along slightly different lines and points to differences in the phonemic structure of biblical and non-biblical proper names in the Book of Mormon, the latter being more structured than the former, which he claims points to, and I quote, a subconscious creative process of generation rather than the more random or stochastic processes of natural languages. Thus, phonemic analysis of the Book of Mormon Onomasticon seems to support two opposing interpretations, one favoring the internal history of the text and its ancient origins, the other favoring an artificial and a modern point of origin by and large. Nevertheless, the various problems and or shortcomings that seem to be endemic to comparative analysis of the Book of Mormon Onomasticon may be attributable in large measure to the problematic nature of the text itself. To begin with, since the original text of the Book of Mormon does not exist, and perhaps it never did, I mean, I think this is something one has to consider, except, of course, in the creative mind of its author-translator, one can only speculate as to its point of origin and or linguistic character. Quite often, the most to come from such speculation takes the form of a circular argument, utilizing ancient parallels to establish the antiquity of the text. The argument usually runs something like this. Since the Book of Mormon is an ancient text, it can be compared with ancient source material. It can be compared with ancient source material, and therefore, it is an ancient text. However flawed such an approach may be, it is important to recognize that few alternatives seem to exist, given the fact that the ancient text, including samples of its script, seem never to have been recovered and or preserved. However, some have argued that the scanty and cryptic references to the original language which appear in the text are a sufficient basis from which to resolve this problem. In this vein, the Book of Mormon refers to its writing system and language as something it calls Reformed Egyptian, a term which Mormon and non-Mormon scholars have argued about for many years. For example, Hugh Nibley has suggested that Lehi, the father of the Nephites and Lamanites, was fluent in the Egyptian language and writing system, and consequently, the plates were composed of both the language and script of ancient Egypt, albeit Demotic. However, Sidney B. Sperry, another well-known Mormon scholar, saw things differently, and suggested that the Book of Mormon was written in the Hebrew language using Reformed Egyptian characters, similar in kind to Meroitic, which utilized the Egyptian alphabetic script, although it was not an Egyptian language. Another interpretation can be attributed to Orson Pratt, a Mormon apostle and student of Hebrew, who believed that the Book of Mormon must have been written in both Egyptian and Hebrew, and that both languages and scripts were employed in the process. I mean, this is certainly hedging one's bets. While D. Michael Quinn, a Mormon historian, has suggested that the Book of Mormon's reference to Egyptian may be intended as a metaphor for mystery, since occult works use the term in a similar fashion. Suffice it to say that statements in the text regarding its linguistic origins and the statements of scholars has only served to confuse the issue. To further complicate matters, though, Joseph Smith also suggested that the language of the Book of Mormon was a dead language that was known only to God, and therefore above linguistic criticism. As Joseph Smith explained, and I quote, "Let the language of that book speak for itself. It reads, none other people knoweth our language. Therefore he, God, hath prepared means for the interpretation thereof. Here then the subject is put to silence. For none other people knoweth our language. Therefore the Lord, and not man, had to interpret after the people were all dead, learning and wisdom of this generation. But Joseph Smith was not the only one to use this kind of argument to deflect criticism away from the Book of Mormon. George Albert Smith, the 8th president of the LDS Church, once suggested that the Book of Mormon's poor grammar and syntax was the product of God's ability to speak with bad grammar to those with bad grammar. Not a good argument. In the same vein, George Q. Cannon, an LDS apostle, argued that in spite of the stylistic foibles of the Book of Mormon, its underlying meaning was the important thing, which the Holy Spirit, incidentally, was also quick to point out if necessary. Syntactical studies of late have even suggested that the awkward syntax of the Book of Mormon may simply be due to its Hebraic origin, as well as a too literal English translation. Could be. Regardless, in the absence of an ancient text, or, as some might say, without the gold plates, it is virtually impossible to know anything at all about the original language and or script of the Book of Mormon, and by implication, the linguistic nature and origin of its onomasticon. But assuming for the sake of argument that the original language and the script of the Book of Mormon could be ascertained, and that it was, as Nibley suggests, a modified version of Demotic from which the non-biblical proper names of the Book of Mormon had originated, there would still be the issue of the nature of the transliteration scheme employed by the text, and phonological ambiguities that might exist because of this. As John A. Svetnes observes at one point, and I quote, "When I had completed my analysis, I noted that the difference between the Jaredite and Nephite phonemic systems was even greater than I had supposed. How was this possible, since both were taken from the Nephite abridgment, which being written in but one writing system could not accurately have illustrated two separate sound systems? Nor, of course, can the English transliteration. Hence, I have really analyzed a faulty transliteration that may not show all phonemes in the two systems under consideration." But in an attempt to defend his phonemic analysis against such criticisms, Svetnes suggests that Joseph Smith's employment of a divine instrument, the Urim and Thummim, during the translation process, ensured that the original phonological structure of the onomasticon had been preserved. I will not take issue with Svetnes' mystical bent. After all, anything is possible when divine instruments are cited. Nevertheless, it should be stated that his argument does not account, at least in my opinion, for the fact that any transliteration of an ancient alphabet using the modern English alphabet is problematic, insofar as the latter cannot adequately represent ancient phonemes for which there are no modern English equivalents. One solution to this problem has been the employment of diacritics, sublinear and supralinear dots and dashes, which have been designed to augment the modern alphabet so that it can accommodate its ancient counterparts. However, such diacritical marks are not evident in the transliteration scheme of the Book of Mormon onomasticon, and therefore even a divine instrument could not, and obviously did not, preserve original phonological structures in the text, to be sure. For example, consider the ancient Egyptian alphabet, which is composed of the following 24 phonemes. Unfortunately, I can't show these to you, but follow along if you can. Remember that each of the phonemes listed corresponds to a completely different Egyptian grapheme, hieroglyph or character, and that without the aid of diacritics, the modern English grapheme H, for example, might refer to any one of four Egyptian graphemes. So in other words, if you came across the English letter H, you had four Egyptian alphabetic letters to choose from. That's basically the idea. Similarly, classical Arabic, which represents one of the most comprehensive Semitic alphabets, is composed of the following 28 phonemes. So that the modern English grapheme S, for example, might refer to any one of three classical Arabic graphemes. In fact, it was this kind of phonological ambiguity that contributed to the production of multiple meanings and translations for Book of Mormon proper names by Carlton and Welch, already discussed. Flying in the face of these seemingly insurmountable obstacles to comparative analysis, scholarship has nonetheless been content to employ a haphazard and a random comparative approach to the Book of Mormon onomasticon that shares little in common with the modern comparative approach. Firstly, without a clear idea as to the original language of the text, any and all ancient comparisons that might be drawn are rendered null and void, regardless of their content. And secondly, even if the original language of the text could be ascertained, the limited and inexact nature of the transliteration scheme employed by the text would hamstring phonological and etymological analysis in the end. Consequently, it may be fair to say that a systematic and a modern comparative approach to the Book of Mormon onomasticon is an impossible task. The Book of Mormon onomasticon, a new methodology. John H. Hayes and Carl R. Holliday, in their book entitled Biblical Exegesis, explain that any historical criticism proceeds on the basis of two perspectives, what they refer to as, quote, the internal and external historical aspects of a document, end of quote. That is to say, text is both a product of the historical and cultural dimensions which it describes, as well as a product of the biographical context in which it was produced, making it possible then to speak of both the history in the text and the history of the text. Since the Book of Mormon on Onomasticon may be said to represent the original text and or language of the Book of Mormon, scholarship has assumed that the subject must be approached from the perspective of the internal history of the text alone. Nevertheless, it is precisely this approach and or historical perspective that has been shown to be problematic, and therefore it may be more correct to say that comparative analysis of the Book of Mormon on Onomasticon is only an impossible task from the perspective of the internal history of the text. Surprisingly, few seem to have considered the positive aspects of a comparative approach to the Book of Mormon on Onomasticon based on the external history of the text. Although the Book of Mormon as a whole reflects a vast corpus of 19th century American literature, sacred and profane, it is intrinsically tied to one source in particular, namely the 1611 King James Version of the Bible. The close literary and linguistic connections between the Book of Mormon and the KJV is perhaps the most characteristic feature of the former. Nevertheless, the extent to which this somewhat artificial kinship can be said to account for the Book of Mormon on Onomasticon in toto is a question which has yet to be resolved on the basis of a systematic comparison between the two texts. At least I have failed to find such a work. On the one hand, there can be little doubt about the biblical origin of no less than 150 proper names in the Book of Mormon, given the fact that they correspond exactly with KJV renderings. It is also noteworthy that this biblical corpus is scattered throughout the Book of Mormon, regardless of chronology, which is often problematic. In an attempt to explain these transliterational anomalies, John A. Svetnes suggests that, and I quote, Joseph Smith had made a concerted attempt to retain the biblical King James spelling wherever the name was already known from the Bible, while he newly transliterated all other names. However, it may be recalled that the same scholar also suggested, or argued, that the Urim and Thummim had ensured phonological accuracy and consistency in the transliteration process, and not Joseph Smith. In spite of Svetnes' contradictory arguments, the important point is that 150 proper names in the Book of Mormon correspond exactly with the KJV, accounting for nearly half of the Onomasticon. Given the fact that nearly half of the Book of Mormon Onomasticon can be linked to the KJV via correspondences, it is not inconceivable that biblical variants could account for the rest of the so-called non-biblical corpus. Thus, the popular assumption that the Book of Mormon on Onomasticon consists of a combination of biblical and non-biblical proper names may not in fact be valid, and the term non-biblical ought to be amended and or replaced by the term biblical variants. It would follow that if the Book of Mormon on Onomasticon is a conglomerate of exact and inexact biblical correspondences, then the entire corpus is biblical in nature and can be linked, or so it would seem, to a decidedly modern source, the KJV, calling into question Blake Osler's contention, and I quote, Hebrew, Egyptian, and classical names which appear in the Book of Mormon but not in the Bible. Though many of these names could be biblical variants, others are difficult to explain as Joseph Smith's inventions. Quite to the contrary, Book of Mormon proper names such as Pa'anki, Pahuran, and Pakumeni, which Osler cites as decidedly Egyptian names, in defense of the ancient origin of the Book of Mormon, can, I think, be explained as variants of the biblical text. But clearly mine is not the first critical work to make such a proposal, nor will it be the last, I imagine. Fawn Brody, in her monumental historical work entitled No Man Knows My History, argued along similar lines, and I quote, of the 350 names in the book, he took more than 100 from the Bible. Over 100 others were biblical names with slight changes in spelling or additions of syllables. Nevertheless, Brody's terse comments seem to be based almost entirely on her own cursory impressions and not a systematic linguistic study. While she may be more right than wrong, and her theory is very much the basis for my own comparative treatment, it is important to note that she unwittingly, seemingly so, describes the Book of Mormon on the Onomasticon as the product of the linguistic phenomenon known as word-making. Not only is word-making a characteristic feature of all languages, I think this point should be stressed, especially modern English, but a common and quite acceptable practice. In fact, it may provide the basis for a comparative analysis of the Book of Mormon on the Onomasticon in total. Word-making, as the term implies, refers to the various ways a language increases its vocabulary to meet the linguistic demands of society. Of course, one way is to simply borrow words from other languages. But even without borrowing, all languages have a variety of ways of forming new words. The following exploratory analysis will refer to five such linguistic processes that are most commonly associated with word-making. These include dialect, reduction, affixiation, derivation, and compounding. A classification scheme for the Book of Mormon Onomasticon in total will also be proposed using this linguistic scheme, as well as a preliminary listing of biblical proper names from which the Book of Mormon Onomasticon may have originated. So it is at this point that I would refer you to the handout, as it may make my summary a little more comprehensible. The first process, dialect, refers to the creation of new words by means of alternate spellings. In the Book of Mormon, these are proper names which seem to share the greatest affinity with the KJV due to strong phonological correspondences. There are three types. One, proper names which are distinguished from the biblical text on the basis of vowel deviance alone, such as the Book of Mormon proper name Amulek and the biblical proper name Amalek. Two, proper names which are distinguished from the biblical text on the basis of consonantal deviance, such as the Book of Mormon proper name Achish, spelled with a K, and the biblical proper name Achish, spelled with a CH. And three, proper names which seem to represent a metathesis, this is the inversion of letters, of the biblical text, such as the Book of Mormon proper name Pachas, and the biblical proper name Pesach. There are approximately 43 Book of Mormon proper names which can be said to fall into this category. The Book of Mormon proper name Mosiah is also included in this list as a dialectal form of the biblical proper name Maaziah, a priest who signed a solemn covenant to reaffirm the law at the time of Nehemiah. In this case, a literary parallel may be intended, since Mosiah's departure from the land of Nephi and his reformation of the people of Zarahemla, who it is said, quote, denied the being of their creator, end of quote, is strikingly similar to the apostasy in Jerusalem that provoked Nehemiah's reading of the law and the reaffirmation of the covenant. In addition, there may also be an etymological connection, since the biblical proper name Maaziah is a Hebrew phrase meaning God is a refuge, which would also seem to describe the circumstances of Mosiah's flight perfectly. The second process, reduction, refers to one of two modes of word creation, back formation and clipping. In both cases, a shorter word is made from a longer one. Back formation, as the term implies, refers to the contraction of words from back to front, while clipping is a more arbitrary process that may consist of the deletion of suffixes, prefixes, and or infixes. In the Book of Mormon, back formation is the most common form of reduction, such as the Book of Mormon proper names Josh and Sam, contractions of the biblical proper names Joshua and Samuel, respectively. I really don't think anyone would want to argue with that. There are approximately 28 Book of Mormon proper names which can be said to fall into this category. The Book of Mormon proper name Nephi is also included in this list as a reduction of the biblical proper name Nephilim, who were the giants and or men of renown, this depends on the translation that you read, who were born of the sons of Elohim and the daughters of men. In this case, a literary parallel may be intended, since the Book of Mormon describes Nephi as possessing both physical and spiritual stature, similar in kind to the Nephilim. The third process, affixiation, refers to the creation of new words by the addition of suffixes, prefixes, and infixes. In the Book of Mormon, the addition of suffixes is the most common form of affixiation, such as the Book of Mormon proper name Ammoniah, an expansion of the biblical proper name Ammon, with the addition of a suffix, which in this case is a common short form for the divine name. Affixiation also accounts for the greatest number of biblical variants in the Book of Mormon. Approximately 68 Book of Mormon proper names which can be said to fall into this category. Indeed, it may interest some that the much-debated Book of Mormon proper name Mormon is included in this list as an expansion of the biblical proper name Merom, which was, of course, the scene of the great battle between the combined forces of Canaan under Jabin and Israel under Joshua. In this case, a literary parallel may be intended, especially when one considers the fact that Mormon is that famous Book of Mormon prophet and military figure to witness the genocide of his own people at the Battle of Cumorah. Similarly, the biblical account of the Battle of Merom tells of the widespread extermination of the Canaanites, such that, and I quote, there was none left that breathed. The fourth process, derivation, refers to the creation of new words by extracting word stems to which suffixes, prefixes, and infixes are appended. In the Book of Mormon, this usually consists of extracting free morphemes and adding suffixes, such as the Book of Mormon proper name Abinadi, derived from the biblical proper name Abinadab, with the addition of the suffix I. There are approximately 20 Book of Mormon proper names which can be said to fall into this category. The Book of Mormon proper name Moroni is also included in this list as a derivation of the biblical proper name Shimron Meron, who, interestingly enough, was one of the Canaanite kings defeated at the Battle of Merom. The fifth and last process, combination, as the term implies, refers to the creation of new words by combining two or more words together. In the Book of Mormon, combination and/or blending is infrequent, and perhaps the most elusive of all the linguistic processes discussed. The Book of Mormon proper name Kishkumen, a blend of the biblical proper names Kish and Kumen, is one example. There are approximately 21 Book of Mormon proper names which can be said to fall into this category, which accounts for the balance of the onomasticon. Note that the comparative tables that appear in the notes and appendix of this paper are by no means intended as definitive and require further refinements, no doubt. And this is referring to the list that you have. A cursory statistical analysis of the Book of Mormon onomasticon based on first occurrence has also been supplied in an addition, in an appendix, which you don't have, by the way, which the reader may wish to peruse. Among other things, this statistical analysis points to a concentration of biblical proper names in 1st and 2nd Nephi, while biblical variants predominate the latter part of the text. It also shows that biblical variants tend to utilize more complex word-making processes as the text comes to a close. Thus, in very general terms, the Book of Mormon onomasticon would seem to begin from a biblical base and move further away from that base. Interestingly enough, this feature and or characteristic of the Book of Mormon onomasticon may be attributed to either Joseph Smith's creative imagination, his abrogationist transliterational tendencies, or even the vicissitudes of an ancient language and grammar that died with the Nephites. But there are also several distinct advantages to a comparative approach to the Book of Mormon onomasticon based on that of the KJV that should be emphasized. Firstly, both texts are contemporary with one another, given the fact that Joseph Smith had access to the KJV and certainly made use of it in the translation of the Book of Mormon. Thus, unlike ancient linguistic and literary source material that may or may not be relevant, the issue of the relevancy of the KJV can hardly be disputed, it seems to me. Secondly, both texts utilize the same graphemic and phonemic systems, which avoids the problem of transliterational ambivalence. Thirdly, since proper names in the KJV can be transliterated and translated based on extant Hebrew and Greek manuscripts, phonological and etymological analysis of the Book of Mormon onomasticon may be possible. At very least, a more correct pronouncing vocabulary can be developed utilizing Hebrew and Greek phonemes and stressed syllables. And fourthly, linguistic connections between the Book of Mormon onomasticon and that of the KJV may point to significant literary parallels that exist between the two texts. Nevertheless, the most important characteristic of this particular comparative approach is that it may provide a common ground for Mormon and non-Mormon scholarship, where both can rise above the level of apologetic and polemic, respectively. In conclusion, aren't those sweet words? The Book of Mormon onomasticon is both mysterious and transparent, above linguistic criticism and yet somehow beneath it. On the one hand, it may be the remains of a dead language known only to God, but like God, it is impenetrable and unfathomable. While it may be said to represent the original language and or text of the Book of Mormon, it is an ancient text that is forever outside the reach of linguistic scrutiny. On the other hand, the Book of Mormon onomasticon may simply be a product of the creative genius of Joseph Smith or some other modern redactor. Regardless, its roots seem to be planted firmly in 19th century America, having borrowed and built upon the biblical corpus of the KJV. Although some may argue that the Book of Mormon onomasticon is itself a modern expansion of an ancient source, that ancient source may be none other than the KJV. In the final analysis, the Book of Mormon onomasticon is probably not, as Hugh Nibley suggests, the greatest bonanza any philologist could ask for in coming to grips with the Book of Mormon. Unless, of course, he is referring here to a stranglehold on the text. In order to resolve this dilemma, a more reliable and valid comparative approach to the Book of Mormon onomasticon is required. The challenge, I think, will be to develop a systematic and scientific comparative approach that can maintain both a high level of methodological integrity while at the same time responding adequately to the phonological constraints, or rather the philological constraints imposed by the text already discussed. This paper has endeavored to suggest one approach that may be worthy of consideration. It certainly may not. Utilizing a series of linguistic processes associated with a phenomenon known as word-making. Ultimately, our knowledge concerning the nature and origin of the Book of Mormon onomasticon may amount to little more than an assurance that we can never know about such matters. For some of us, this is reason enough to raise the question anew. Thank you.
I may go over by about 5 minutes. I timed this the other night at 14 minutes and then have reduced it down since then. I'm going to be unable to respond to everything in Clyde's paper because I didn't get the revised version, which is about three times the size of the original, until yesterday. And then I came down with a flu, had diarrhea and headache and fever all night long. So I really only looked at some of the pages, but I think most of what I'm going to say, though, there may be a few quotes that are no longer accurate because a few places were changed. I will read it because I want to be as concise as possible. Though I agree with some of Mr. Forsberg's statements, I fear that my response will be mostly negative. I found both self-contradiction and a misunderstanding of some very basic principles of etymological research. Time will not permit a full discussion of these matters, so I will cover some areas of major concern. I have no serious quarrel with Mr. Forsberg's definition of comparative philology, but it has nothing to do with etymology, the study of word origins. Comparative philology is, as he has pointed out, the historical study of related or cognate languages and involves an examination of phonology, morphology, lexicon, and, to a lesser extent, syntax. Thus, by comparing Spanish with French, one learns that they share a great deal of lexicon and morphology, and that the phonological differences between them can be explained by regular sound shifts. Since the English of the Book of Mormon is not closely related to Hebrew, Egyptian, etc., Forsberg concludes that it is not amenable to the comparative philological method. But then, we're not dealing with the comparative philological method. We are dealing with a text containing names purporting to be transliterations from the original language of the Book of Mormon. Were I to write the Hebrew word shalom and spell it S-H-A-L-O-M rather than Shin Lamed Vav Mem, would any of you doubt that it was a Hebrew word just because it is written in our alphabet? Or what are the names found in the King James and other Bibles? We readily accept most of them as Hebrew in origin. The difference, of course, is that we no longer have the original Book of Mormon plates to cross-check the transliteration. Forsberg fails to comprehend the nature of etymology. He insists that scholars working on the Book of Mormon onomastican are pretending to use comparative philologistical methods was the one that got me, not philologistical, a pretension none of us makes. Because comparative philology does not admit of comparisons between unrelated languages, Mr. Forsberg believes it wrong to seek different linguistic origins for various Book of Mormon names. In other words, you can't have some that are Hebrew, some that are Egyptian. Every language, however, borrows from its neighbors, even when they do not share a common mother. Names are perhaps the most frequently borrowed of words. A poll of those present in this room would perhaps disclose only a few first names which are really English in origin. My name, for example, is John. It has no English etymology whatsoever. It derives from the Hebrew Yohanan, meaning Yahweh or Jehovah is gracious. But employing Clyde's reasoning, the name cannot be Hebrew since English is the language of my parents who gave me the name. Now, he didn't say that. That's not a quote, but that's the same kind of reasoning. Were I to write a story about two girls named Mary and Veronica, you would likewise be hard-pressed to find English etymologies for their names. Mary, in fact, derives from Hebrew Miriam, meaning exalted, while Veronica is a combination of Latin vera, true, and Greek ikon, image, plus the Latin feminine suffix a. What's that, he said? A single name combining elements of more than one language? That sounds too much like Nibley's explanation of Iriantum to be true. To reason that Book of Mormon names cannot be Hebrew or Egyptian because that volume is written in English is unacceptable. Forsberg does not admit the possibility even that some Book of Mormon names might be Egyptian in origin, others Hebrew, etc. Thus he criticizes Paul Hoskisson for not confining his study to a single language family as the basis of study. And he criticizes me for suggesting that Jaredite names appear to derive from Akkadian and Sumerian. His footnote 35 in the old version, I don't know what it is in the new one, reads, John H. Witness reference to Sumerian and Akkadian as a phonological basis for Jaredite names is disturbing given the fact that the latter is a member of the Semitic language and the former is not. Each belonged to quite different linguistic families. First of all, I did not in fact say that the Sumerian and Akkadian were the phonological basis for Jaredite names, only that the names had Sumerian and Akkadian etymologies. The same is true of some biblical words. For example, the Hebrew word hechal, temple or palace, is a borrowing from Akkadian, which in turn borrowed the word from Sumerian, egal, meaning great house. In other words, the etymology is Sumerian, not Hebrew. And biblical names like Esther and Mordechai, as also Meshach, Shadrach, and Tebed we go, are Akkadian. Other Bible names are Egyptian in origin. For example, Aaron, his grandson Phinehas, and Ammon. These are not simply my opinion. They are well accepted in the field of biblical and Semitic studies. Forsberg claims that the Mormon approach to the Book of Mormon onomasticon is a parody of ancient rabbinical interpretation, mostly because both approaches are characterized by a striving for the production of multiple meanings. Thus, Carlton and Welch are said to utilize, quote, a segmentarian pseudo-etymological approach producing multiple meanings. In actual fact, they and most other Book of Mormon etymologists are forced to present several non-simultaneous possibilities because the names are known to us only in transliteration. The rabbinic method, on the other hand, deals with known biblical words and presumes that all of the etymologies are simultaneously valid. That does not mean, however, I agree with everything Carlton and Welch did. I disagree with much of what they did, as a matter of fact, and with most of what you said regarding their work, I agree. The question of the written language of the original Book of Mormon was written is still being debated. Forsberg notes that Nibley believes it was Egyptian, while Sperry and others have proposed that the spoken language was Hebrew, written on the plates using Egyptian characters. Forsberg, of course, accepts neither view. But there is evidence that the script of the Book of Mormon was a combination of Egyptian and Hebrew characters used to represent Hebrew as the spoken language of the Nephites. Two items are of particular interest. In 1965, a number of ostraca were uncovered at Tel Arad in Israel. Most of them were written in Hebrew and dated to 598 to 587 BC. Another, dated to the 7th century BC, was written in Egyptian hieratic. 2 years later, another document from shortly before 600 BC was found at the same site. It was written in a combination script comprising Egyptian hieratic and Hebrew characters. Of the 17 words in the text, 10 are written in hieratic and 7 in Hebrew. Of the 7 Hebrew words, however, only 2 mean anything in Hebrew, and they have this same meaning in Egyptian, for a reason which will become clear. The other 5, while written in Hebrew letters, are actually Egyptian words. That is, we have a document with Egyptian as its underlying language, but written in a mixture of Egyptian and Hebrew characters. In 1978 and 79, several ostraca from the same period as the Arad documents were found at Ein el-Qudera in northern Sinai. Some were in Hebrew, others in Egyptian hieratic. One of the documents, written mostly in hieratic, was peculiar in that the word thousands was was twice written out in Hebrew, while the standard Hebrew symbol for shekel was used several times. Thus, there is evidence, though minimal at present, for a writing system similar or identical to the one used by the Nephite scribes and dating significantly from the period just prior to Lehi's departure from Jerusalem. I suppose what concerns me most about Clyde's paper is that he uses totally opposing arguments to support his claims that Mormon scholars are wrong in their assessment of Book of Mormon names. Here are some examples. First, at one point he criticized the work of Carlton and Welch for being too rabbinic and that they present multiple meanings for each of the names. But he is closer to the mark when later he states that, quote, this problem of phonological correspondences between modern and ancient phonemes was one reason for the multiple transliterations observable in the linguistic study offered by Joanne Carlton and John W. Welch, unquote. Well, we can't have our cake and eat it too. It's one or the other. In refutation of scholars such as Sperry, he has told us that, quote, the Book of Mormon's reference to both Egyptian and Hebrew as the original language does not make any sense. Since these two languages are not related to one another, it means that there can never be a comparative philological basis from which to work. Later, however, he revised this statement that Hebrew and Egyptian are unrelated, using the new stand to refute Nibley. He notes that, quote, Hugh Nibley's theory can be said to fall flat even if one accepts his list of Egyptian proper names, since such phonological correspondences would only prove to substantiate a cognate relationship between the language of Lehi and ancient Egyptian. In fact, there are other instances I found of contradictions on this principle. At one point, I'll skip that. You can see the point, I think. I should note, however, that Egyptian and Hebrew are, in fact, related. Egyptian, along with Somali, Jeba, Chadic, Hausa, Cushitic, and some other African languages, belong to the Afro-Asiatic language family to which the Semitic languages also belong. Moreover, borrowed Semitic words and names are frequently found in Egyptian texts, while some Egyptian words and names are found in Akkadian documents and even in the Bible. Forsberg notes, and I quote, Nibley's suggestion that Book of Mormon proper names compared with Egyptian proper names are never exactly the same, unquote. and criticizes, quote, this loose phonological correspondence, unquote. His own purpose, he's not loath to use them, as he did in seeking the origin of the Book of Mormon names in the King James Bible. Indeed, he wrote, in the first one, I didn't see if it was in the second, quote, but a comparison between the Book of Mormon onomastica and the KJV need not be restricted to exact correspondences only, since biblical approximations may also be present in the text, unquote. Well, I'm not saying by this that he's always wrong. Mr. Forsberg is very often right. What I'm saying is, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If we're going to use the argument against Nibley, let's stick to the same standard for ourselves. Okay, I noted at the beginning that I did agree with Clyde on some points, so in fairness to him, let me mention a few here. I, too, find myself at odds with Hugh Nibley on some issues. For example, the inexactness of the phonological connections between Book of Mormon and Egyptian names is certainly not evidence for the validity of the identification. If anything, it is evidence of the difficulty of transliterating Egyptian names into English. Besides, different Egyptologists would, in fact, transliterate these same names in different ways, except when using the standard diacriticals. I also agree that the study by Brian Stubbs, which, unlike onomastic studies, really is an attempt, and I'll put that in quotes if you agree with me on that, at comparative linguistics, and it is faulty. Farms gave me the opportunity to review the preliminary paper, and I returned a very unfavorable report. To my dismay, they had already announced the release of the paper before I received it. Mr. Stubbs is currently working on a revision, which I cannot, of course, judge until I've reviewed it. Forsberg's suggestion that Book of Mormon names may derive from names in the King James Bible is a topic for valid research. If this was Joseph Smith's source, several possibilities present themselves. First, perhaps Joseph invented the names using the procedures outlined by Mr. Forsberg and based on King James names. This, by the way, does not bear directly on whether he also invented the story of the Book of Mormon, though this is obviously what critics will make of it. As Forsberg pointed out, many Book of Mormon names come directly from the King James Bible. To the believer, this merely indicates that Joseph used the familiar English form of those names whenever he found them in the ancient record. In a few cases, Joseph Smith used a descriptive English word as a place name, for example, bountiful and desolation. Thus, it is not impossible, as has been suggested, that Joseph's explanation of the name Mormon as a combination of English and Egyptian gives it away. Those were your words in the first one. I think you changed it in the second one, but it's possible, certainly possible. But I tend to believe that Joseph was not serious when making this statement. There are other instances when he pulled the leg of his detractors by deliberately outrageous statements, and Brigham Young did it even more often. The famous story of Oliver Cowdery going into the doorway that opens up in the hill Cumorah with Joseph and seeing the plates and the sword and all in a cave, which obviously can't be true since moraines don't have caves in them, was told by Brigham Young, and people always read it out of context. They never note that just before that he told two other tall tales, one of which was about Martin Harris finding some Nephite gold. Stories which never happened, you know, and I think Brigham Young was just pulling people's leg. I don't think he took these seriously at all. If, as Forsberg notes, Book of Mormon names are based on real morphemes, bound or unbound, which form part of the names found in King James, then we need not look to the King James for the source of the names, for we know them to be mostly Hebrew. Indeed, if it could be demonstrated that the names always comprised valid morphemes, here's your task, then it is unlikely that Joseph used King James unless his prophetic powers extended also to understanding the Hebrew originals behind those names. So too, if the Book of Mormon names have meaning in Hebrew, Egyptian, etc., then we need not look to the King James Version as their source, if they really do all have meaning. That's something that has to be examined more thoroughly, obviously. I recommend that Mr. Forsberg pursue the King James possibility. It may be that I will not agree with some of his conclusions, but from a strictly logical point of view, it is a valid topic for research. I do have some suggestions, and I can't give them all here, but the one most notable was the name Nephi, which I don't see how that could come from Nephilim in Genesis 6, since the word Nephilim does not appear in the King James translation. It's only in the Hebrew of that. I think it's much more likely that the word Nephi, if it comes from the King James, came from the Apocrypha. I believe it's in 1 Maccabees where the word is used, the name is used. And if you knew that Joseph Smith's family Bible, Joseph Smith's senior family Bible, was a King James version that had the Apocrypha in, that helps. So I would look to that kind of thing rather than to the reduction types of explanations. I further recommend that he avoid talking apples when the rest of us are talking oranges. Etymology and comparative philology are different issues. Think about it this way. If the Hebrew text were no longer extant, could we use the King James as a source for the etymological study of Old Testament names? And an aside, if so, what about the non-Hebrew names in the Old Testament, of which there are quite a number? If such a reconstruction is possible for the King James, then it must also be possible for the Book of Mormon Onomasticon, if one accepts that it is a translation of an ancient Israelite document. And in the long run, I suppose that's what it comes down to. Does one accept it or not? My mystical approach, if I may use that term, doesn't sound scholarly to the crowd at Calgary, as Clyde and I were discussing yesterday. However, I found no real problems with it in Jerusalem, and I found that such prominent people as Chaim Rabin, the president of the Hebrew Language Academy, was using the Book of Mormon frequently to show Hebrew syntax to English-speaking students, rather than using the King James, because, as he said, the Book of Mormon illustrates it much better. And when I did, when I took a class in Semitic and Afro-Asiatic etymology from him, I frequently used the Book of Mormon to illustrate some of my etymological contentions. For example, the Hebrew word place, which literally means place of arising, and often is referred, used in the Bible and other places, Phoenician records, for example, to mean a tomb. In the Book of Mormon also refers to that. There are 11 examples in the Book of Mormon where it refers to a tomb or a place where someone died. And when I used these, he thought that was great. I always got A's. So so there are some scholars who think that there's nothing wrong with using the Book of Mormon. I think it's a question of whether you think it's a valid topic for research, either as an ancient document or strictly as a modern document. And of course, I see it quite differently. Thank you.